This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Each year in late December, we look back over the past 12 months to find the stories we especially enjoyed telling. This year, we spent a lot of time talking about people with autism. We found out about the help that children with autism receive both in and out of school. But school doesn't last forever. And we found out that once they graduate, these former students can find themselves with little to no help at all.
That's a very sad thing when a person has worked and a family has worked for all the years of public school and suddenly, boom. Nothing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll look back at our segment about what can happen when a child with autism becomes an adult. We'll also spend an academic minute with government, help, and trust. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Since the year 2000, there have been a number of policies and regulations enacted on the state and federal level to help children with autism get an education. But eventually, those children grow up, and much of the help those families have been able to access is no longer available. So what's next? Where can families turn when a child with autism becomes an adult? In the back of a building at the ARC Gateway campus in Pensacola, there is a large industrial paper shredder next to a big room filled with tables and people sorting papers. One of those people is Nikia Houston, who describes her job duties.
Yes, to shred paper, to sort paper.
Nikia is one of about 275 people with varying disabilities, including autism, who are employed by ARC Gateway. It's one of the few places that have programs and job opportunities for adults with autism who have aged out of the school system. For school-aged children with autism or other qualifying special needs, local school districts must create an IEP, Individualized Education Plan. Implementation of that plan is monitored and adjusted as needed according to current federal and state regulations. After that, services get scarce. Last week, we heard from Jennifer Finley, a behavior analyst at the Autism Center at Sacred Heart Children's Hospital and the mother of a child with autism.
We actually have a lot more services for them when they're children compared to what happens once they become 18 or 21, and now insurance isn't covering them, or they're back in the Medicaid system, and what do they do for an employment, and how are they going to be sustainable, and how as a community are we going to be able to support them? And I think that's an area as a whole that we really need to work on, because our kids are not 3 years old forever.
We say they sometimes graduate from school to mama's couch.
Susan Byram is the president and CEO of Autism Pensacola.
And that's a very sad thing when a person has worked and a family has worked for all the years of public school to push and improve and build skills, and suddenly, boom, nothing.
When you talk to people who deal with children and adults with autism, you invariably hear about the wait list. While there are programs and services that help adults with autism live and work independently, the money for those programs is in short supply.
Those are all funded through an agency called the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. And as I mentioned to you, that agency has a waiting list of over 20,000 individuals across the state.
Being on a wait list for services is a fact of life for families seeking help for a loved one with autism. Dr. Christine Ogilvy, an autism consultant for FSU Center for Autism and Related Disabilities, or CARD, even advises her clients on managing the list.
I try to tell them at the middle school level, get on the list for vocational rehab, get on the list for APD, because you're going to be on a waiting list and it's going to take time.
And the sooner someone gets on the list, the better. Melissa Rogers is the CEO at ARC Gateway.
You can get on anytime after your third birthday. Once you get an official diagnosis from a doctor, a physician of your choice, of a developmental disabilities, you are eligible to be on the wait list. It's a referral process. It's very easy to get on the wait list once you fill out all the documentation and meet with a state representative. However, the people that are coming off of the wait list are the ones that have the more severe needs. They could be homeless. They could be, have no caretaker involved with them. And so the average individual that is safe in their home, living with their family, is not going to come off the wait list very quickly.
For those people still on the list waiting for funding, there are agencies that offer help. Dr. Ogilvy from CARD says their services are free of charge.
We provide some kind of job training with them as far as working with them with job skills, going in and working with the employers and providing them with autism awareness and giving them different tips and hints for, here's something that you can do to accommodate the needs. And that's something that we found very, very helpful as far as keeping our young adults employed. Everything that we do is free because we're a state-funded grant. I do a lot with one-to-one work with clients, and then we have our adult groups that we do, and that's more of a social, aside from the interviewing skills.
According to 2014 figures from the Kaiser Family Foundation, the wait list for enrollment in Medicaid Section 1915C, home and community-based services waivers, in the state of Florida is the third longest in the nation, behind Texas and North Carolina. Kaiser reports other states, including New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire, and California, do not have a wait list for services through that waiver. One tool that is available to adults with autism in the state of Florida is a grant through the ABLE Trust that provides money for job coaching. Tara Potter is the director of TRIO Employment Network, which is now operating out of the Pure Empowerment Center at Marcus Point Baptist Church in Pensacola. She is a job coach who works with adults with autism.
The first thing we had to find out is, did they get a regular diploma or did they get a special diploma? And that's very important because a special diploma is not going to get them very far in terms of being able to continue education that would help them with employability. And aging out is a difficult thing because they've had services in school and then all of a sudden they have no services. And then they'll find out oftentimes that all the time, that the services are very limited that they have here with the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. They'll apply with them. There's a grant called ABLE Trust Grant that is dedicated specifically for supported employment, so they can go to the APD, apply with them, and try to get that lot of money, which is $5,000 a year. I know it sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot, you know, when you're working with a job coach to try to find something that fits your skills and abilities. We teach life skills, social skills training, and employment skills because it's not just about getting the job, it's about keeping the job too. So oftentimes our young men and women with autism just don't have very good grooming. They just detest it, really. I mean, things like brushing your teeth and keeping your hair clean and keeping your clothes washed and cleaned. It really is a common problem with young adults with autism, anyone on the spectrum. And I have two sons that are on the spectrum, and I can tell you my 28-year-old really still struggles with getting as many baths as he should and keeping himself groomed. There's also some other things that prohibit people with Asperger's and autism in the workplace, like just obstinance and, you know, not going to change their way of thinking. And, you know, there's just sort of isolating of themselves in a workplace environment. So what we do here is we try to teach social skills. We try to teach flexibility. We try to show through some tools that we use what one's strengths and abilities are. And we focus on that, not on the disability, not on what doesn't work, but, hey, what does work in this young person's life? And focus specifically on that strength to place them in employment in the first place that they're going to enjoy. You know, we want to all enjoy our jobs. It's not just a person with autism. I mean, all people want to do something that they enjoy doing. So we spend a lot of time doing person-centered planning and discovery and getting to know that individual so that we can place them, first of all, if they're not ready to go into paid employment, we'll find a mentorship anywhere in the community that fits that need to that person. We'll go and cultivate that mentorship so that they can try out work and try it on and try out that boss and that environment and see what works for that person.
Once someone is placed, once someone gets a job,
Yes.
Is that it, or can they come back for follow-ups or brushing up on the social skills? Or?
Oh, that is never it. Just getting the job is the first step. There's many steps that follow. We have a tool called a retention plan, and the retention plan is designed to really develop a relationship between the employee and the employer, and it's facilitated by the job coach. But really what it does is it outlines, okay, in written terms, here is the job that is expected of me. And it, you know, it's written out. I'm supposed to clock in at this place at this time. This is how I clock in. Some people don't know how to use the clock. So we teach that. It starts really there, you know, and then it goes on to what is my job description? What is a day in the life of my job? And that is all written down. And if there's any deficits that the young man or woman is experiencing, then we go to the employer and say, you know, this is what we have found. Do you have any ideas about how we can, you know, help this person to overcome this deficit? And that is the job of the job coach, the manager, and the employee. It's a team effort. And when you start things that way, the manager already becomes vested. And then he wants that person to succeed. And so you get a natural support, is what we call it, on the job side. And a good job coach will cultivate natural support so that when they're not there, someone else is there that can help that individual to remind them of something that is written on their retention plan that they're working on. And that goes on and can go on for a year or more. And, you know, if it's not a good job fit, it will show itself within about 6 months. And then we go on our way and we find another job and we learn from that experience. But if it is a good job fit, the supports need to be there to assist that individual as long as they need it. Things like supervisor changes will bring in a need for a job coach to come back. Any kind of major change in the company, any kind of major change, you've got to keep your pulse on what's happening with the individual. Stay in touch so that you can come back and help them when needed.
Do these companies come to you or do you go to them?
I go to them. Like a hound dog, and have to find them and explain to them that this is not a mercy hire. This is a person that has the strength that you're looking for. So my job development experience is just as extensive as my experience with working with young men and women with autism. I have to cultivate those relationships with the small mom and pops, many of them hire, as well as the large corporations, Hobby Lobby. Walmart is a big employer, Walgreens. They have an initiative, some of them, the national chains such as Walmart and Walgreens, to hire diversity. But in addition to that, they still need training. And so the job coach often, with their tools, like the retention plan that I just explained, can help them to see that if you hire based on an individual's strength, for example, we've got a young man that's really good with numbers, and he can remember numbers like nobody's business, and he doesn't mind those little bitty numbers that are on the paintbrushes, you know, those little bitty code numbers that he has to code in. Oftentimes things that are really, really small won't scan, so somebody will have to read those numbers and code them. That might be a very laborious job for most. But for someone with Asperger's who really likes to do that kind of thing, that's a strength. You meet the strength with what the employer is looking for, and then you have a wonderful match. And that's really the key to supported employment, is matching the right person with the right employer.
Tara Potter is the director of TRIO Employment Network and is a job coach for adults with autism. Still to come, many people who work with children and adults with autism do so because members of their family are living with the condition. We'll talk to one next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Many of the people we've met who work with or for people with autism have a member of their family who is also living with autism. One of them is Susan Byram, the president and CEO of Autism Pensacola. It's a nonprofit in the northwest tip of Florida that acts as a local clearinghouse of services for children and adults with autism and their families. I spoke to Byram about those services and some of the roadblocks that face people with autism as they age out of the school system.
There definitely are opportunities, but again, only if you are receiving that funding through the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Another way to fund that is through vocational rehabilitation, which is a federally mandated program that each state, you know, kind of implements in their own way and with their own funds to help those with disabilities find employment. The challenge is the spectrum is so broad, but everyone with autism, I believe, has huge potential to contribute if we are creative enough and find a way to tap into that potential. And of course, we really want employers to be willing to take a chance and find a way. If there's a concept called job carving, and often you can come into an employer's place of business and find a niche that a person with autism could fill and fill in a really meaningful way where they could be very helpful and contribute, reduce the workload on others, and have a successful, meaningful job for themselves.
We'll get a little personal here. You have a son.
I do.
Who has autism.
Mm-hmm.
He's
the greatest ticket taker at the Pensacola Blue Wahoos. Thank you very much.
There you go.
No, he does love that job.
Your son lives on his own.
Yes.
He does get some support services, though. Mm-hmm. Talk about those services.
Yes. Well, David, we were lucky that David, we were on the waiting list when we first moved to Pensacola. He was 11 years old, and he went on that waiting list. But about 4 or 5 years after we moved here, we were able to get a little bit of funding to help him begin to learn some skills at home, how to take care of things and so forth. So by the time he was about 19, we were able to move him to his own apartment, which he did share with a roommate for multiple reasons, most of all financial. But also it gave me a level of comfort. This was a person who'd been living on their own, even though they also had disabilities. They were experienced, if you will. But then this agency provides for him a person to come into the home and support him in, you know, cleaning and caring for the apartment and so forth, as well as taking him shopping and to appointments and that sort of thing. And, of course, I still do offer a lot of support to him, transportation and so forth like that. He's going to need that from me for a long time.
Byram says that no matter where someone is along the autism spectrum, she feels there is a place for them in society.
We believe in autism acceptance. It's not about fixing something or curing something. It's about maximizing potential in every human being. And mostly the ones we focus on are those with autism, obviously. And just reaching out and building a better community that can support everyone. That's part of our core values.
But are there people who simply do not possess the skills to be employed? Melissa Rogers is the CEO at ARC Gateway Pensacola. They employ people with various disabilities in their shredding business, which we heard from earlier, and also an on-site nursery and a craft store.
Yes, to answer your question, there are people. We do have a philosophy of employment. We believe that everybody can work in some way, shape, or form. It just might not be at the same speed as you and I. Unfortunately, those individuals who are not going to have a, quote, real job in the community, they have to be a little bit more creative. So we put them in some of our day programs if they're eligible for the day program and if they have funding, a funding source. Then they can work in our plant nursery, our manufacturing contracts. We have a program called Adult Enrichment where we have about 40 individuals who are artists. They go, they do arts and crafts and then sell their pieces in various places in the community, whether it's a restaurant downtown, we sell some of our stuff there, or arts festivals around the community. So they'll make money off of selling their art pieces. There's also through vocational rehabilitation. If somebody is ready to work or has the motivation to go to work, whether or not they have the full set of skills, they can go to vocational rehabilitation, which is operated through the Department of Education. You can meet with a voc rehab counselor who will assist you in the process of finding the perfect job for you. They won't maintain a relationship with you once. Usually it's only for 90 or 150 days once you find a job. Then they close your case out with vocational rehabilitation. But at the end, you've found a job. So that's open to some people. Not everybody is going to be ready for that next step, though.
If you employ somebody in the nursery or the shredding business, do they have does that job ever time out, or are they here till they want?
They can be here as long as they want. Okay. We also believe in retirement, so we do have a senior adult program that once you're 55 years old, if you're tired of shredding or tired of working in the plant nursery, then you can move on to our senior adult, which is more like a retirement program where you can relax a little bit more. But you have to be a certain age to get into that.
Melissa Rogers is the CEO at Arc Gateway in Pensacola, Florida. Now, of course, we've been focusing on one area in one state. Each of the states have their own programs with varying degrees of funding. And many localities in a state can have programs and organizations who can help families and individuals living with autism continue to grow and learn long after they leave school for the last time. A good source of information and a good place to start would be autismspeaks.org. Will trusting the government keep you healthy? Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but it is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What exacerbated the Ebola crisis in Liberia? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Blair, assistant professor of political science and international and public affairs at Brown University, examines what trust in the government had to do with the spread of this deadly disease.
Beyond the lives lost and livelihoods destroyed, the recent Ebola epidemic in West Africa laid bare the deadly role that distrust of government can play in allowing an easily preventable virus to spiral out of control. In collaboration with the Governance Lab at MIT, my co-authors and I conducted a representative survey of Monrovia, Liberia between December 2014 and January 2015. The survey was designed first and foremost to help identify neighborhoods that were hardest hit by the epidemic, places that were in urgent need of assistance. But it also provided a wealth of data to help us better understand the factors that exacerbated the crisis. We found that Liberians who expressed low trust in government were much less likely to take precautions that might have slowed the spread of the virus, like washing their hands with chlorinated water. They were also much less likely to obey the nighttime curfew or the ban on public gatherings, and much less likely to support other contentious policies designed to contain the epidemic. Contrary to some findings from research on vaccine hesitancy in the U.S., we found that Liberians who distrusted government were no less likely to understand Ebola's symptoms and transmission pathways. In other words, they declined to take precautions against Ebola not because they were ignorant, but rather because they didn't trust the capacity or integrity of government institutions to implement policies and issue guidelines that would effectively slow Ebola's spread. Overall, our results confirm that epidemics are often driven as much by social, cultural, and political factors as by epidemiological ones, especially in settings where institutions are weak and distrust of government is high. Researchers and public health practitioners should account for these dynamics when designing interventions to prevent crises like Ebola in the future.
That was Robert Blair of Brown University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.